Jonah.
Jonah.
Nice to meet you.
Welcome to the June 8, 2011 Landmarks Preservation Commission. First item on the agenda is roll call. Those present, Chair McIntyre, Vice Chair Maddox, Commissioners Sundell, York, Eckley, thank you, Luce, and Jensen, and ex officio McClintock. Second item on the agenda is consent agenda, excusal of absences. No one is called in for this meeting, but as a correction to the May 25th meeting, I move that Ha Pham be included in the list of excused absences. Is there a second?
Second.
No discussion. Is there all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Okay. Motion passes. Item three, chair comments. There are none at this time. Item 4A, historic property inventory, Michael Sullivan.
Okay. Hi.
Hello.
This is Spencer Howard with Artifacts as well. Can we advance this from the keyboard, Tom?
I can mouse. Not the mice.
Well, I know all of you have been watching the preservation plan document and the policy side of getting that planning document converted into policy at the city. Kind of a lesser known aspect of this endeavor was that as part of the preservation planning effort, there was going to be a survey or an inventory of some select kind of sample areas throughout the city that were going to be there to kind of test some of the policy ideas and so on. And you know, when we got into conversations about it, there was just such a variety of expectations and ideas about it that we realized instead that instead of looking intensely at a select number of individual properties, if we used existing databases, public records, GIS, and some of the technology tools we've got, and by the way, Tacoma is very sophisticated and as far as GIS, ESRI technology, we discovered that, hey, you know, instead of trying to solve this problem by invariably disappointing somebody by picking an area of the city that leaves somebody out, what if we looked at it the other way? How much information do we have if we just went for the whole thing? What if we took all the data on the entire city and looked at what we came up with as tools approaching it that way? Ruben found a way to work on that. This corresponds with the Department of Archaeology and Historic Preservation starting to build their big statewide database, and we discovered that we could pull all of the data out of the county assessor's office and create a citywide map and look at all the properties in the city that are 1969 and before. So instead of surveying a handful, we're looking at about 40,000 properties in the city. And we now have data, meaningful data, in a granular, consistent, citywide overlay that gives us information about about not just existing historic properties, not just not just looking at the stars that are in our galaxy, but being able to look into deep space and look a long time away at where are our future historic districts, where are our concentrations of potential historic districts 20, 40 years from now, where's their integrity? And partly to satisfy some of the economic development and some of the planning people, where are those not? So that if you want to think as planners about where do you want to do things where you don't have to come into a train wreck with historic preservation, where are the holes, you know, where do we go for it? So we're going to show you just some of these tools to take in mind that these are all screenshots frozen in time where the real tools that we're talking about are liquid and movable. They're dynamic, you know, they're animated tools that we can create reports and documents and look at, use them for analysis and so on a very, very flexible level. I'm not a big time nerd, but I gotta tell you, Tacoma, this is so cool, you guys. Tacoma is so far ahead of any other jurisdiction. Even at the national level with the National Trust, their people are stunned at the tools we've got now in Tacoma. So it really is. So bear with me. Spencer understands this. If you have even one question that goes deeper than what I'm saying, I'm going to refer to Spencer because he built most of this stuff and understands it much better than I do. But I want to take you a little bit through the process we went through and then give you just a few ideas about, in terms of analyzing projects, creating tools for yourselves, looking at future policies, looking at areas we can go to create protections in the city through policymaking. We've now got the data and the support to be able to take some pretty major reaches in terms of protections and stuff. So, first of all, I think everybody's understanding of what assessor data is, public record assessor data, is probably undersells the amount of information in assessor record. For every single parcel in the city, not only do we have a data construction, and admittedly, it's not perfect. You know, they round up and down sometimes, but it's really good to have that. On a level with about 8 or 9 different gradients, the assessor records give us a grade of every property as to the quality of original construction from, packing crate framed garage that may be at the bottom or an outhouse practically, all the way up to top grade size, you know, everything at the top, all broken out about a span of about 8 different positions, and that exists for every property. The next thing they gave us is current condition on about the same level. So they take over from uninhabitable all the way to excellent, and all kinds of stuff in between. So terrific amount of data in terms of looking at property in a citywide way. Let's go forward one more. The other thing Tacoma's got that any city that had this would just die for it. For any of you who have used the building index at the Tacoma Public Library, Brian, Gary, those guys have spent 40 years going through looking at street addresses, putting together data about original builder, about original architect, if there's an architect. Every newspaper article, everything that's ever printed, bibliographies on properties, the most modest residential properties have got files on them. 30,000, 50,000 was it? 50,000 properties listed in there, including a trove of historic photographs. So, gee, wouldn't it be great if we could merge that? The library was totally willing. All that data was merged, so we created a new database that uses assessor information, physical information, square footage, all that kind of stuff, and merges it with the historic significance and backstory narrative about the buildings, all built into one big tool that we had. So the next step from that was to take the data, once it's all merged, and figure out a way, since the assessor was looking at condition from an assessor standpoint, and they were looking at original construction from an assessor standpoint, we needed to have some sort of a translation into values that mean something to us as preservationists. Basically, integrity, original integrity, condition is certainly part of it, but we also wanted to have a system to evaluate based upon historic significance because we've got the historical background. So we created a set of categories, and you can see them right here, that basically give us a range of properties. From individually eligible National Register properties all the way down through National Register contributing, individual local register, contributing to a local contributing property within a register, looking ahead two or three categories that look at, you know, maybe it's a mid-century or a building like you guys were just talking about from the 50s, but looking ahead 25 years, this may be a national register. So a grading scale that gives us all that and loading it into a database. Now, this is in a GIS database, so it's infinitely searchable. If you've got a project area, if you've got a neighborhood and they want to know where's the biggest concentration for a potential historic district, if you've got a bunch of neighbors who are saying, you know we've got character in our neighborhood, but we can't quite put our finger on where it comes from, suddenly here's a tool to be able to look at that neighborhood and say, you know, a big part of your character is imparted from these properties, and here they are, and show them the data to be able to look at that. And all that is in a fluid, usable tool to be able to do that. So let's go ahead. This gives you an idea. That gives you a breakdown, those last, gives you numbers in terms of numbers of properties in each of the categories, in the various categories. This projects those properties onto a city map, parcel by parcel. And here's a detail that we were looking at kind of over in the brewery district at the head of Foss Waterway that is just a simple map to be able to call up as a report that gives you date of construction, and then it gives you the ranking in terms of property all the way down from National Register all the way down to ones that have no significance or even intrusive properties. And admittedly, these are all converted into our value system, so they may not mean anything to a real estate agent, you know, or they may not have a big effect on market value, you know, and those kinds of things. But from our standpoint, it gives us the information that we want, and it gives it the information on a even overlay for the entire city that we can call up. So this is cool, you guys. You're looking kind of blank, but let me tell you, this really, don't fall asleep on me, because there's so many cities to have a predictive model. I mean, archaeologists develop predictive models to tell you where there might be, you know, archaeological sites. To be able to do it in a built environment is unheard of. People just aren't doing, nobody's attempted to even go into this world that we're aware of. So we're to have Tacoma be at the front of it. And just think for a second about what it does in terms of creating tools and policy measures for the kind of stuff you guys do. You know, to be able to instantly, if somebody comes in and wants to look at a historic district, or you may be wanting to know, somebody wants to tear down a house or dramatically modify it. If it's, you know, the last one of its type in the whole city, or the last one in a category, you'd be able to know really quickly. So in terms of analysis, it's just great for that. So let's go ahead one more. Another great thing we did was to look ahead at these next two slides deal with sustainability principles and trying to merge better the historic preservation goals with sustainability objectives. Big sustainability objective for a city like ours, Tacoma, is a handmade city. Most of our buildings are made out of wood, and they were made by hand. And Tacoma, by the 1920s, we were encircled by incorporated cities over the quarter of our city limits that isn't saltwater shoreline. So we were completely locked in, and we were done in the 1920s. With the exception of the far west side, west of Pearl, we basically were finished, and most of our buildings are out of natural, renewable materials made by hand, which means that the materials are infinitely reusable. They're masonry, they're solid old growth Douglas fir, great materials. Our biggest problem is, and I think I've talked to you about this before, it bewilders me. The way we operate our landfill and our solid waste is that we use subsidies from our ratepayers to minimize the real cost of landfill disposal for demolition and construction waste right now. We don't charge people at the landfill the real cost of disposal. A 1,500 square foot house made out, conventionally framed, built out with a concrete foundation, everything, 60 tons basically at the landfill. Real cost of disposal at the landfill, what the city pays to ship it off, about $120 a ton. In some cases, it's headed up too. Could be 150. The real cost of disposing of a house you want to tear down should be close to $10,000. Instead, it's about $500 because it's subsidized. So we can extrapolate from the assessor records and from the information they give us about construction methods, type of construction, square footage, number of stories, physical information. We can come up with a figure on exactly what that waste, what is the bulk mass and weight for disposal of a building, and create a disincentive for tearing down buildings that are that have reuse possibilities. Not every building you can save, and some buildings have been so mucked up that really, you know, it just doesn't make sense. But when a alternative, like deconstruction and reuse of materials, is matched against the disposal cost of $500 for a demolition permit, there's no money in it. There's no market for it. But if it's $10,000 to dispose of that building, now there's a business for somebody to go in and put in the labor, and there's green jobs to be able to do that. Now we have the data to be able to say, hey, you know, maybe we ought to modify the way we issue demolition permits. And we use some of the other tools to say, these are particularly valuable buildings, so we want to really make sure that they pay every environmental cost before they're allowed to before that house is, or that building is demolished. So great to have this tool also completely fluid, ready just instantly there, and something, the kind of hard facts that you can create meaningful policy around as far as preservation goes. One more. Another cool thing is that Tacoma has a very sophisticated public utilities. And with the CLIC network and stuff, they've created a system of monitoring energy use for buildings at an extremely detailed level. Now, one difficulty is that because of public disclosure laws, you can't just walk in and say, give us the, per address, give us the history on energy use. They won't do that. But we worked through with them, explained what we were doing, and they broke it down to the block level. So they gave us energy consumption background by block. So what we did then was to go to blocks in the city that were, if not 100%, at least the majority, the vast majority of the properties within that particular block were all within one construction decade, so that we could then pull out data on what's the energy efficiency of it. And, you know, we all kind of know this, but this is really an area to think about building tools for. Right now, the Tacoma Public Utilities Conservation Program will put vinyl windows in any building you want, practically, and give you a break on financing them. Now we can go back and say, hey, you know, first of all, the windows aren't the number one inefficient thing about buildings that are built in the 1890s or buildings built up to the 1920s. And maybe there's a way to create a standard treatment for replacement with wood windows or other efficiency improvements to buildings that are tailored to particular construction types or particular construction decades. And that door is open. TPU is willing to do it. As we develop more trust, the ability to access more specific information about energy efficiency and use over time is really going to open up for us. And I think you all know this, but you know, the buildings built before 1950 are more, use less energy and are more efficient than any buildings built after that, except starting in 2000, where buildings are getting back up. So only in 2000, by the decade, are we starting to get back to buildings that are efficient, the buildings that were built before that. And our historic buildings have efficiencies like operable windows, which in many cases they've lost operability, and that's the number one reason why they've fallen off. And it's not even that the data shows that they're inefficient so much as the psychology of people that are there start thinking that they're not, that it's not there. They start believing that's the, buildings that have got radiators. God, it's the ideal way to deal with heat in buildings is radiators. And yet today, when somebody who once probably sold vinyl siding now is selling new energy efficient, you know, heat pumps in houses, the first thing they want you to do is get rid of the radiator, hot water radiator system, and go to some kind of a modern gee whiz system. We can now go back and say, hey, you know, you're not getting anywhere with that. The cost of amortizing those kinds of improvements to get the minor improvements that you get over the life cycle of the building is ridiculous. You know, you're much better off. Here's the typical building. Your house was built in 1920. Here's the best way to do it, and Tacoma Public Utilities will help you with the cost. So anyway, so there's infinite number of ways to use this analytically. I know you're kind of tangentially aware that this is kind of like running in the background, you know, off screen, sort of during the preservation planning thing. But it is something that came out of the preservation planning process that really puts us way ahead. And when we talked to Ruben, we just wanted to make sure you were aware of it and understand. And I'm sure we'll have more conversations as it comes up and as you develop ingenious ways to use the tools we've got. But these are really cool tools. So.
And we can send you the PDF of this section if you want it.
And we didn't print this out, but everything I just gave you, including bunches of wonderful charts that will give you a much better understanding of all this, maps and charts are all available in this form. We also can send you this even in a better way to get it. It's a section in the preservation plan, but it's almost better to get this on your, to get it as a digital document because the hyperlinks inside it all work. So it's actually a little more usable in that format. And the maps that you see are actually in the digital version are in high res, so you can zoom in to your house if you want to. Needless to say, let me just leave with one last thought I meant to mention earlier. The one thing that wasn't in the property inventory process was we did a sampling. We drove through a significant amount of the city to test all of the values that we were giving, but we didn't go house by house, which means there isn't a current generation of photograph, which is kind of the core document in a lot of surveys in the past. But the reality is, with Street View now on Google Maps, it would have been, I mean, why do that? Why not spend your time getting the data ready to use? So companion this with Street View, and you can have your constantly updated current images to go along with it. So,
how do we access this information? How do we access this information?
Well, right now, Tony's going to get this to all of you. She'll get you a digital version of this. What we're currently working with, Ruben is working with the city's GIS system, so eventually all this data will be available to anybody who wants to go online and use the city's public access.
Yeah, the GovMe website.
GovMe.
Yeah. Any questions or comments from commissioners? Thank you very much.
You bet.
Appreciate it.
Thank Great. You. Thank you all for getting this preservation plan done. I think it's a great... I know we all hated seeing Luzon go, and we thought, man, this so sucks. But actually, you know, out of that came the initiative to get a preservation plan. And, we did pretty well, I think, in terms of putting ourselves back together after that experience. So, anyway.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Just as a update for... the transcription of the meeting minutes, Commissioners House and Al-Janabi entered just before item 4A. And the background for item 4A as per the staff report. Did you want to read the staff report for this section?
I'd like to introduce Chelsea and Levy.
Right.
And she's new urban planner with the Community and Economic Development Division. And she's going to talk about the new downtown marketing plan, or the process of that and the scope of that.
All right. We'll leave the background per...
What did I say?
Yeah.
And then parking.
We'll leave the background per agenda. This is item 4B. Ms. Levy?
Thank you.
Continue.
Thank you. Hello. Well, that was a fascinating presentation, and I'm not confident that mine will be as fascinating. My house was built in 1896, so that information is really, you can kind of geek out on that for a while. So I'm here today to introduce a topic to you that the Planning Commission has just started to review. The City Council is interested in eliminating parking-related barriers to new development within the downtown. So they're interested in moving towards what they've coined as a market-based approach to parking within downtown. We've seen this already in the implementation of paid on-street parking back in September. So that's one example of a market-based approach to parking where it's more demand-oriented. And for off-street parking, a market-based approach comes in the form of eliminating requirements for parking. So essentially, a developer or a lender would be able to determine how much is the right amount of parking for a new development within the downtown. So I'm going to walk you through this proposal, and I'd love your feedback. It has some implications for the historic and conservation districts within the downtown. That was the map, this very colorful map that I sent out earlier with your agenda, but we'll talk through that, and really feel free to interrupt me if you have questions as I go on. I'll try not to get too techy or use too much plannerese, but please stop me if you have questions. So as I mentioned, the council's interested in moving towards this market-based approach to parking, and specifically they want to eliminate the minimum and maximum parking requirements for new residential and non-residential buildings in the downtown core. So if you turn to this really colorful map, you'll see this boundary here, and the streets are on the flip side. But this yellow line encompasses the boundary that the council's interested in eliminating the parking requirements within, and it includes the downtown commercial core area, which is kind of the raspberry color there, as well as the historic overlays around Old City Hall and Union Station and the University, and then the conservation districts that kind of buffer those historic areas. And that's why I'm here today, because this proposal directly impacts those areas. So there is some policy guidance for moving towards a market-based approach that actually the update to the comprehensive plan in 2008 dictates that we should move in this direction. And kind of the first example of that was in 2009, the council eliminated the minimum and maximum requirements within the International Financial Services area. So on this map, this context map on the first page of your packet here, you'll see the blue line is the designated, what do we call it, regional growth center. So the Puget Sound Regional Council has said, okay, Tacoma, you're going to take growth and you're going to focus it within this regional growth center here. And so the council's response to that was to say, okay, well, we're going to even go further than that, and within this orange boundary here, we're going to create this international financial services area, and that's where we want to really focus growth around the financial services sector. And you could read that as Russell, or you could read that as other financial services-related companies, but their first step was to eliminate the parking-related development requirements to try and incentivize new development within that area for the financial services sector. So this proposal essentially takes that boundary and the requirements that were eliminated within that orange boundary and expands it to a larger area, which is that yellow line there. And I'll talk more about the specifics in just a second. But first I wanted to talk about the existing parking requirements in the downtown to give you a sense of what we currently require. And there's quite a few of them, so I'm not going to go through all of them, but I'm just going to talk about the ones that I think are most relevant to this group. So parking requirements in downtown are different than anywhere else in the city. So in the neighborhoods, we are very specific in saying if you're going to open a restaurant, then you have to provide this many parking stalls per 1,000 square feet, versus if you're going to open a movie theater or even a putt-putt golf course, we get down to like that fine-grained detail of requiring a specific number of parking stalls per those uses. Well, in downtown, we're more general about it, and there's really just two categories. We either say, if you're a residential development, then you are required to build this many stalls per unit, or if you are a commercial development, a non-residential development, then you're required to build this many this many stalls per square foot, or 1,000 square foot. So there's just two categories there. As I mentioned, there are existing minimums and maximums within the downtown. There are not, however, they've been eliminated within the International Financial Services area, except for there's still a provision for accessible stalls, and that will move forward with this this proposal as well. Even where we've eliminated the parking requirements within the IFSA, you still must provide an accessible stall either in the development or within the vicinity of the development. There is a 15% reduction for the amount of required parking with east of Market Street. So that essentially runs for the additional amount of transit that's provided east of Market. So there's the Link Light Rail line that runs there. For now, at least, we have pretty good bus access in that area of downtown, and it's a pretty walkable area. So you get kind of a bonus You don't have to build as much parking if you have good transit access. There are no requirements for the reuse of existing buildings except for if you're going to expand. So if you have kind of a property with historic character, you don't have to, and all you're doing is renovating the property, you don't have to build additional parking. It's once you move towards an expansion of that parcel or that property that our regulations would start to kick in. But with this new proposal, we would be eliminating all of those requirements except for the provision for accessible parking stalls. So as I mentioned, this proposal builds on this boundary, the IFSA boundary, and the elimination of the minimum and maximum requirements within it by expanding the area. I talked already about the boundary, but it would basically create this newly defined area within the downtown. And also that accessibility provision that I mentioned is set to expire, and so this proposal would make that provision permanent so that you would be able to provide accessible stalls either on the parcel, within the building, or adjacent to it in some kind of easily accessible way. So that is the extent of the proposal. It's not too complex. It's really just taking what we already had within the IFSA and expanding it to a greater area. But it does impact the historic areas, and so I'd love to hear your thoughts on it. The kind of the timeline for this is that it's going through a planning commission process right now. There's a timeline on the last page here. It's going through the planning commission. It's been introduced to them, and I'll be going back to them next Wednesday. And the reason that I'm here today is because they're looking for some preliminary community feedback on this proposal, kind of thumbs up or thumbs down, or wait, we have other ideas about this. And then it will go to the city council later this fall, and the whole process is intended to be completed by the end of the year before the accessibility provision expires. So are there questions? Thoughts?
Question or comments?
I have
Commissioner Sundell.
This has nothing to do particularly with Landmark, but I'm just curious, how do you handle parking then when you don't require it in new development?
Well,
where do people park?
Well, it's not that you can't provide it. It's just that if you're a developer, you have the option not to provide it. But what we found is that generally developers will provide it, and it's either because they believe their tenants will need it, or the bank will say, well, we're taking a risk in lending you money, and if you're unable to pay your debt and we have to take the building back, then we want it to be a marketable building, and we know that in this day and age, other people that would be interested in purchasing your building would only do so if there was parking provided within it for the number of office spaces or whatever that are provided. So we're not making an assumption that no parking will be built, but the direction from the council is that we want the private sector to decide what is the right amount of parking for a development.
So how long has IFSA been?
Since 2009. And that's actually an interesting point. You know, we already in 2009 we were headed towards a recession, and so the IFSA parking amendment was created with the hope that there would be this would kind of be a test area, and there would be some examples of new development that would kind of test this philosophy, and then we just kept getting deeper and deeper into the recession, and there hasn't been new development outside of the Park Plaza development, but that's a parking garage in itself, so it's not really a good test model.
Other comments or questions from commissioners?
Well, I'm just curious because there's already so many parking problems in downtown. I think maybe I'm missing something, or because I understand how this would have drawn, say, Russell or someone coming in, but since they're not coming in anymore, is it that there's hope for other future big tenants, or?
It's true. So this is kind of, this is a long-term strategy. So I think that the council's seen the current state of downtown as a short-term problem, but this is a really long-term strategy to attract development. And the last thing they want is for our parking regulations to be a barrier to future development or investment in the downtown. So taking these regulations out of the picture, the intention is to...
There's at least one parking structure being planned, am I right? Or is it just completely in theory?
Associated with the Elks Lodge, or which?
No, I thought there was, with the leftover Russell money that the governor pledged, I thought they were using that to build a parking structure.
It's a surface parking lot. They're actually doing it right now. I think they should be done pretty shortly here, but it's right next to the DeVita building along Pacific Avenue. So I walked by today, and they've just finished paving the sidewalks. So.
It's the old Soros site.
It's a Soros site. Mm-hmm.
And the parking problem is a bit of a misnomer, too, because there's plenty of empty parking spaces in the stalls, in the garages, the downtown garages. It's people are making the adjustment of not being able to park on the street for free. But there's still plenty of parking that you have access to within the downtown core. It's just no longer free.
Okay.
I mean,
there's plenty of parking. It's just that you have to be in a parking garage.
Well, or pay for on-street parking. And the on-street parking is actually a lot more accessible now that you have to pay for it.
Well, I know.
So, I've heard a lot of that. And working downtown, being downtown on a regular basis, it's a problem of perception, not an actual problem of quantity of parking that's available. And I'm kind of in the old school of I don't have to pay for parking in downtown Tacoma. It's Tacoma, but that's, you know, it's part of the tide. You know,
yeah,
the tide.
I just
didn't know
if there was enough, and that's why I was curious.
Yeah, I mean, because I work in the Park Plaza building, and frankly, that garage is half empty, so it's underutilized as far as the parking. But that parking garage has been there forever. We added capacity to it. We added more floor parking, but. There's a lot more empty spaces in that garage than what were added. So, I mean, there's some excess capacity in parking downtown.
And that's a really good point. And you're absolutely right. There is, I would almost go so far as to say there's significant existing capacity in the existing garages right now. And part of that is the loss of Russell. You know, they used to take up the whole A Street garage.
Right.
And now there are very few vehicles parking in there on a daily basis, is my understanding. But that will change over time because this is a long-term strategy, right? And the parking capacity is a problem. I mean, to have an excess in capacity, it really is a problem because then we're not using our publicly funded facilities to their fullest extent, but that's a short-term problem. So really what we're looking to do here is prepare for the future.
And this is a strategy that a lot of other cities use.
Well, they had started talking about it pretty early, actually around 2002, 2003, and it's finally getting around to being implemented.
So how is this going to affect the historic districts?
So currently within the historic districts, particularly around the Union Station and the university, a new development in that area would be required. If it's not on the historic registry, a new development would be required to build parking based on whatever our square footage requirements are. And so so by eliminating the parking requirements, it's possible that a developer would elect not to tear down the building because they wouldn't have to provide they wouldn't have to provide the parking. And so sometimes it's the parking that's driving the project, right? So there we require X many parking stalls per square feet, and if they don't have to provide additional parking, then there's a possibility that it could preserve buildings with more historic character or kind of preserve a more historic form within the conservation district.
Seems to me that it would have the effect of probably more positively impacting than negatively impacting in that regard, because it gives more flexibility for rehab options.
I hope so. You know, there's always the possibility that you hit a developer that's going to do a tear down regardless. But
there are roadblocks in place to that already.
You're absolutely right. Yeah.
So Chelsea, the buildings that are currently on the register or that are contributing structures within the historic district, they are already eliminated from parking.
And that's part of the what you did this year, or what's going through the council right now with the 2011 amendments.
This won't change the fact that those buildings will have to go through design review through this commission and so on and so forth. So I don't. Maybe I'm not thinking far enough out, but I don't see it having a negative impact on the district.
Ruben and I were trying to think of that, like, if there would be a negative implication for that today. And, you know, maybe, so there will be no parking maximum. The proposal is to eliminate the parking minimums and the parking maximums. The Planning Commission had a conversation at their last meeting about, and there were some commissioners that were maybe interested in retaining the maximum. And so I guess you could hypothesize about something where a developer would want to build a lot of parking, right? And without a cap on the parking that you could provide, you could get a kind of ugly urban form. But I don't know how true that scenario is, because there's a real cost associated with parking. For surface parking, we estimate now it's between about $20,000 to $25,000 a stall, and for structured parking, it's up to like between $30,000 and $45,000. So it's unlikely that a developer would really overbuild the parking if there's not a maximum on it. But you never know. So,
go ahead.
That hotel that was built in the conservation district, or it's going to be Holiday Inn Express.
Mm-hmm.
They had requirements for parking,
mm-hmm.
and so that would not necessarily.
Their project, my understanding, they've already submitted their permits.
They're
so
grandfathered
they're busted.
In,
right?
Yeah.
But if they were not grandfathered in, then they would be under this.
They would not have a parking requirement. Yeah.
So that's another impact to the historic district.
But a building like that's a great example of somebody
they
that would build parking. They want parking on site.
Exactly.
They
right.
They would
yeah.
probably almost over. They would be the one that would almost overbuild their parking,
mm-hmm.
in the hopes of somebody else paying to use their parking.
Yeah, because
in addition.
It's a short term
right.
clientele.
And so, yeah, a market driven approach has worked pretty successfully in a lot of other places.
So I should also mention, related to that, that there is not a maximum currently if you build public parking. So one thing that a hotel, we haven't seen that, but we have seen instances where a developer will build above the maximum because they're providing also public parking. And that's actually happening in almost every instance of new development where there's some sort of public access. A good example is the Elks on Broadway. They have public parking within their development, and they are providing more than the maximum allows, because 100 of those stalls are public parking stalls.
Any other comments or questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you. Great. So can I just ask, just to make sure I'm understanding you, it sounds like you're in general agreement and think that we're eliminating minimums and maximums is the right direction.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
Could they still contact you then?
Absolutely. And if you go home tonight and all of a sudden realize, think of a great example where this could be a disaster. My contact information, I think I included it in your packet. I don't have cards yet. I'm that new that I don't have cards. So here's my contact information. You're welcome to call or email me. There's plenty of opportunities still for this commission or you as individuals to comment. We'll be going through the Planning Commission process for the rest of the summer. I would say if you're going to write a letter from this commission, which I encourage you to do if that's something you're interested in, before the July 20th Planning Commission meeting would be the right time to do that. But you can always catch this in the council process as well. So,
thank you.
Yeah. Okay.
Thank you.
The next item on the agenda is Board Business Preservation Planning. Item 5A is Camp 6.
And Ruben was hoping to come back from a committee meeting that he was called into to talk about that. I have a couple things I could bring up, and hopefully he shows up. If he doesn't, we can leave.
or if you have other things on his business. One item that we brought to you last time was, or I did, because Ruben was not here, was a letter, communication letter, that someone wanted to be removed from the historic district, historic landmark status designation, and on Star Street. It's a new owner, fairly new property owner. Anyway, the staff is looking at that with the legal staff right now, and so that may be brought back to you. I just wanted to let you know. And in the new historic preservation plan, we did a whole process for that, and I just wanted to correct too that there isn't really a process right now for removal in our ordinance, so but it is going to be in the new plan. In the new plan, or it is in the new plan, I should say. And there's a whole process for that of demonstration and public process for someone who wants to be removed from that status. So. And Ruben's not back yet, so he really wanted to talk about camp sex.
Well, we may have to just defer it until such time as he gets back.
The next time.
Are there...
unless he's bringing drinks with him.
From the council meeting.
Before we conclude and adjourn...
We're still on that.
Are there any announcements or from commissioners?
I had sent an email response into Ruben wondering about the old town preservation process and where we were with that. Didn't get any response from him. I was just kind of curious if there was a, do you have a status on that?
I do, and I'm sorry, I kept the wrong notes up. We don't have it fully counted yet, but we have about 180 surveys, and most of those are no, so probably 125 are no. And around 30 are yes, and the rest are neutral. Some people have made a lot of comments, and we're also verifying the addresses. We just want to be really comprehensive when we report back to the commission, and that will be next month on the 22nd.
And I think probably the general assumption is that it's going to be a no, but I really feel like we need to kind of talk about the criteria for when it comes up again. Should there be some criteria? Because I feel like there's probably a 10% group or something like that down there that really wants this to happen and may make another shot at it. And if we discuss it and come up with a little bit of criteria of what needs to be in place before it is considered again, it may simmer the pot a little bit or something.
And right now it's, and some of you know better than I, of submittal, and I think the statement is just if people in the community want it.
Right, well, the two options were either individual or thematic, and so it looks like that's going to be their only way from now on, is to either do individual property designation or as a thematic if there are a group of houses in within a block or within a couple of blocks.
But I think you're asking what constitutes an application review and the more specific of the...
I am, because
what is
this
the
group
desire,
that came this time...
What's the criteria for the desire of the owners?
Right.
How do we decipher that? Excuse me.
Yeah, that in essence is it, because I think this group that presented the application this time were somewhat under the impression that they were going to get a majority vote, or that it was going to cruise through or something like that. And as people buy and sell homes, who's to say a group like that can't come together in Old Town in 2 years and do it again? And if we had a little bit more specific criteria of if this is going to be presented to the historical committee, rather than spending the taxpayers' money to send out postcards and jump through the hoops that we have, or spend the time that we have discussing and bringing groups together on this thing, is there a more clear message that we can present?
Well, I think we have to work towards making this a definitive
action in that it sounds like overwhelming no vote. So there, I think for those who actually want designation, I think they can pursue designation on their own homes and even others without any problem. And I'm sure they have a business district association, as do all. And there would be no problem putting it up historical markers and that sort of thing if they want to do that. Several others have done that already. But I would be looking for making this survey somewhat definitive so this does not come back in 5 or 10 years.
I think one of the things that Ruben mentioned, I can't remember exactly the term that he used to describe it, but it was a similar sort of thing was done in the Hilltop area, where there had been an attempt to create a relatively large historic district, which failed. But then the determination was made that the contributing structures within that boundary, if any of those individual owners wanted to individually put their homes on the register, then that process was facilitated by the fact that the research had already been done and accepted by Landmarks. So it was a much faster...
It was a multiple group.
That was in 2004.
Multiple property designation.
Yeah, Gary Eisman did most of the research work for that, and that was done in 2004.
And so that would be one way to kind of, as it were, kind of put a cap on it, but let individual owners within the area put their homes on the register quickly. And then I think another piece of this would be to look at if there are blocks or whatever where there are groups of owners that might be a way to form some smaller districts.
Yeah, and then there are neighborhoods like Prospect Hill right up the, you know, right adjacent that just about every house on that block, you know, on that bluff could qualify, mm-hmm. and are not necessarily. So I would be looking for, I agree, there needs to be a criteria, but I would look to see, and we could do it through our own motions here, that we don't want to see this come back as a district necessarily, but leave a process or make a process to streamline or give those owners who are in favor of it the streamlining ability.
I think those ideas are excellent. They're an excellent way to diffuse a group like that and to give them avenues to take care of individual houses or small groups, absolutely. I was hoping, though, that we could put something together that says to small groups who may want to try to corral a large district once again, say, wait a minute, you have to go through a few more hoops here before you can do that.
Well, what we can do is, when this comes up, we can make a recommendation to the Planning Commission, since the Planning Commission is going to review this, and they can make a criteria over and above for future instances that may come up in this room.
That's what I'd like to see.
I actually would disagree. I mean, I agree with all of the feeling, and I think the whole situation is a bit ridiculous that all these people are unhappy, and I definitely don't want unhappy people being forced to do a district, but, you know, what if, because first, I think it's a unique situation because they've already done the nomination, however high the quality of it may be, but they've already got like 200 pages worth. So it makes sense that some historically minded individual, and we happen to have a couple living in the neighborhood, would take that up and, you know, in 5 or 10 years, maybe try to make another go. And I don't want to throw a roadblock down in case they pick a section that makes more sense or
Let's make it 5 years, and since a lot of people... Well,
oh, I'm okay with putting a time limit. I just didn't want
I'm
to
just
say
saying, like, make
ever.
It 5 years.
Oh, yeah.
All the work has already been done. So as houses change ownership, there may, you know, the next owner in may, you know, learn about it and want
sure.
it. So in that five, we'll just have a 5-year moratorium. I'm just throwing this out.
No, it's fine.
Right.
Well, it was clear from that trip we took, the site tour, they drew a line around every building they thought should be in it. And that was the problem. They carved off too huge a land group because they just wanted to include every building they thought should be in it. So I think it ought to, you know, like you were talking about how, pick a small core section that these buildings
sure.
is where we start.
Right.
Well,
and you get all those owners in total agreement.
Well, you get the sort of Croatian fisherman houses and the sort of fish shanties,
mm-hmm.
which really they're on like 2 or 3 streets
right.
and about 2 blocks wide.
That's
where it should start.
And maybe they need some education on how to work this process. They just tried to do everything all at once.
Well,
it was too much.
In fairness, though, too, it exposes a little bit of, and I don't know how you close the loophole, but when that nomination came in, the petitions that were submitted with it and the information that was submitted with it, on face value, looked like a pretty solid,
mm-hmm. it did.
A pretty solid presentation. And the fact that I think there's something to be said about the fact that it essentially sat for 3 or 4 years, kind of from the time that it was prepared to the time that it was presented, and I think your point, Duke, about if you get enough turnover and you get enough of the kind of that shift in mentality, and you know, I think frankly, the timing of it within the economic climate that we're in probably had as much to do with the negative sentiment as anything.
Yeah.
But there's a bit of a hole in the process that if that presentation gets put together and it sits just long enough, it's not going to have the same momentum. It's not going to have the same qualities. And then it gets presented, and then somebody else who has forgotten that they signed a petition 2 or 3 years ago in favor of it is now going, wait a minute, I don't want that.
One of the things,
so,
I think that was certainly something that happened in this case. But one of the things that I think we didn't do, and I didn't think about it at the time either, is we didn't look at just the simple mathematics of the number of houses that they were asking to be included,
mm-hmm.
and the number of names they had on their petition.
Mm-hmm.
And if we had
right.
just simply done that, we would have seen that they weren't close.
50 near houses and only 119.
Yeah. Because I agree with you, I was thinking, wow, they've got 140 names on their petition and so forth. That's really good, you know,
mm-hmm.
and so forth. But I wasn't thinking about how many properties they were talking about in the
yeah.
whole thing, and it was really probably less than 4.
To be honest, I actually thought about that, and to me, that it was about probably about a 40% number, and for me, that was enough of a representation of that, you know, of a sampling. It was a big enough sampling to at least get it into the process, and maybe that's kind of the threshold that we need to look at is maybe that number does want to be higher so that you prevent kind of this backlash of such a large group of people.
One of the things that I would hate to see happen that I've heard coming from council members as a result of this is that it turns into a simple vote matter
yeah.
of the community. Now, to a certain extent, there's always got to be support within the community for this. That's always got to be the base of it. But at the same time, I think that we really undercut the point of the Landmark Commission and the whole purpose of the registry and so forth if we simply make it a matter of a vote within the community. That it's that the criteria that the commission uses is elaborated in our bylaws and so forth, and so and those are arguably objective criteria that we use to make that assessment, and that's what I think we need to work to try to keep as the goal here, as opposed to a simple vote. But there always has to be community support for it, absolutely. But one of the things that I've talked with Ruben about before is I really don't like the idea of this mailing out the cards and so forth, because having been through this process before, that's not the way to do this. You've got to go around and you've got to talk to people. It's got to be door to door. It takes a long time. It takes a lot of work. You know, and if it just turns into a vote, then that's, it's not going to happen.
Well, I think from what you and Commissioner Sundell and Vice Chair Maddox was saying, is the process in this, there wasn't the consensus building process over a long period of time. They just took the signatures that they had and ran with them, and which was a small representative section, maybe just those 140 or 119 is what I remember, only those houses should have been on the district. That's probably what should have happened, rather than trying to include the 350.
Yeah. And that would, and so it, in a certain sense, it comes back to us and to staff to work with a neighborhood to say, okay, here's kind of the way you need to do this, and that you know, let's take a small step and build on it and so forth, rather than just sort of going, that's what they want, you know, saying, well, we want to include all of these. It's like, well, that's not going to work.
Well, that's like the wedge. We didn't listen to what the people wanted there, one group. We said, no, these should be in the district, because that was the logical, historic thing to do, to save that integrity. So it can't be just a straight vote, because if that were the case, those would have been out of the district from day one. We have to do our job, too.
Well, yeah, I wouldn't propose it become a vote. And I guess the only thing that I would say to that is that there was that first public information meeting. There was, for all of the people sitting in that room, there wasn't one person that stood up in favor of it. And that was resounding enough for me to go, wait a second. You know, I mean, had it been split 50-50, Then I think you definitely have to start applying that thing, that there's such overwhelming and resounding kind of defiance.
And I went to a meeting four years ago when they were just getting started, and they had probably, I don't know, 60 people in the room and so forth, and everybody there was in favor of it.
Yeah, yeah, and it's, you know. Yeah. At some point you're at the mercy of who shows up.
That's right.
The biggest damage was the time lag. That's what
And the economic conditions right now, people think, oh God, I may have to unload my house. How am I going to do that? You know,
They don't want extra layers of
encumbrances
right
on the
property.
I'd like
to have a better understanding of the timeline, because if it's a staffing issue that we can only push one district through because of the staffing we have, which is, you know, you guys are overworked. But if we get, say, McKinley Hill or some South End or something out by the Narrows Bridge, and we get two or three districts coming at us, and they said, okay, well, we can do one at a time, so you're 2 years from now, and you're 4 years from now, and you're 6 years from now. That is, and then I think, as Marshall's pointing out, if we want staff to work with those districts, that's one concern I'd have, is if we have to stack them out, you know, I don't think the Old Town would have made it even maybe 2 years ago. Or 4 years ago, whenever it first came through, but it certainly lost momentum as a result of whatever our process was that pushed it out. So I think we have some culpability there, potentially. I think the second thing I was thinking about that is, you know, is there a process that we can have the public information before we accept the proposal, which I understand maybe that isn't possible under our current rules, so we can say, we've received this, come talk to us, as opposed to we received it, we want to move forward, now come talk with us.
Well, the red flag, this was my third time with this particular district. Starting, I think, in 93, 94, they started through and they had the problem with the business owners along 30th, North 30th. Then they started again in the, 2001 or so, and they were rejected again at that time. So the third time through is not, it's actually, there's the amount of opposition is actually growing.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think probably as a result of the two attempts being put down, the people that were opposed to it are that much more opposed to it. So they're
right,
that much more vocal about it. And that was what I got out of that it was people that were as vehemently opposed to it because they had felt like it was something that they had already dealt with and they just didn't want to have to deal with it again.
Right, and that comes back to the original comment that how do we make the process so we can put a moratorium until the next time it's...
This is the best process.
Yeah,
yeah, and
which
may be
because seriously,
you know, we have a new historic district as of this week.
Yeah.
So.
Yes.
Yeah. And how long did that take, beginning to end?
11 days.
Oh.
No.
From the council.
4 years.
Council approved it to my desk.
Yay, it's really quick.
Yeah, 4 years.
2008.
Actually,
you just scared everybody in the Old Town District that it would take such a short period of time. 11 days.
What?
It's been a long day.
I mean, what?
Yeah, 2000. No, they started 2007.
Where my desk is.
That's what a lot of those people were afraid of. Am I already in the historic district? What happened?
Well,
any other comments or questions before we adjourn?
We'll talk next time.
June 22nd, Elks on Broadway design review application and Old Town survey results. We are now adjourned.